Economic Alliance presents the Gulf Coast Growth Show, your show for the coast with the most growth, with your host, Jason Lee and Clint Aiken.
All right, and welcome to the Gulf Coast Growth Show. I'm your host, Jason Lee, and this is
Clint Aiken, and this is your show for the coast with the most growth.
He is so good at that.
Takes practice.
Yeah, there's no way I'll ever get it. And we're here with Stephanie Water from Hunter Buildings, and we'll talk a little bit about that here in a minute and why she's really here on the show. But really today's topic, while it is driven around Hunter Buildings and what they do, is really centered around educating our audience on a lot of the things and the precautions and the things that are taken to create safety and really some of the environmental impact. I think there's always so many moving pieces. People don't realize why we have the things that we have in place, and I know our Chad Burke really wanted you guys to come in and talk about some of the things that y'all are doing. So we're excited to have you today, and I'm going to turn it over to you to kind of tell us a little bit about Hunter and a little bit about some of the work that you guys are doing.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank y'all for having me here. I appreciate it. I'm in a sales role with Hunter. I'm a regional account manager. I've been with them about 7.5 years. Hunter itself has been around for 20 years. We're celebrating our 20th anniversary this year. What we do, the main thrust of what we do, is we design, build, deliver, and install modular buildings that are designed specifically to protect occupants from a number of types of threats. Blast, toxic release, ballistic threat, forced entry threat, and weather hazards such as hurricane, tornado, that sort of thing. That's what we do. That's what we've been doing for 20 years. We started out doing really temporary buildings. Our owners, we're a privately held corporation. We have two owners, Mark Massey and Sam Laverne. They saw a need. They saw a developing need for, there was a lot of call for to protect workers in the oil and gas industry. And we started out with a lease fleet, just temporary applications for turnaround, maintenance projects, expansion projects, that sort of thing, and developed from there. Started doing custom projects. It's been a long road, and there's some things that led to that, but that's where we got started.
Well, I'm going to have to make sure that I don't let my wife see this episode, because y'all were talking about all the things that could protect her, and she's that person that watches like the murder mysteries and all the different things, you know, and so she's liable to be like, oh my gosh, that's what we need. We need one of those buildings that can keep everything out, and then we'll be just fine. But do they have one that, like, with the staircase, and it's got to have? Yeah, you don't want to mess with that. So
we're probably not going to see your buildings on a tiny house episode.
Yeah, exactly.
Painted as you want them to be.
Yeah. No. So I appreciate you coming on the show. That's fantastic. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about why it started. Right? Where did these? You're saying the brothers created it. They saw a need, but where did it come from?
Well, we were around before this, but in 92, OSHA introduced the concept called PSM, or Process Safety Management, whereby owners or operators of hazardous situations, meaning if you have let's say the refinery has an alky unit, they have the responsibility to protect workers and to mitigate the effects should there be an upset condition. So that was introduced in 92. In 95, they introduced the concept of facility siting. So again, this was all through OSHA. If you think about a refinery or a chemical plant, somebody would come in, a company would come in, I don't want to name names, they would come in and consider what might be the worst case scenario. If this unit has an upset condition and there's an explosion or a toxic release, at what point, how far from that origin point does the hazard, is it 10 feet, is it 20 feet, is it 100 feet? So a facility siting map that's done, it looks like basically concentric circles. Okay. And it tells the owner of the plant or facility what is the worst case scenario in that particular area. And so once that was introduced, people started to, or owners and operators started to realize, okay, in this area, we have to have this type of facility to protect our worker. And that's kind of where this got started. So most of the refineries, especially refineries, not necessarily as much with chemical plants, are very old in this country. Mm-hmm. They were built, most of them, in the 30s, 40s, something like that.
And you shared the last refinery that was built was 1972.
I believe so.
Yeah.
Some permits have been issued since then for some newer facilities, but nothing's really been built. A lot of the control rooms and operator buildings and things where workers might be during their whole shift are very old construction. Cinder block or brick don't have leak-proof windows, you know, that would protect somebody inside from a toxic cloud, that kind of thing. And so a company started looking at, well, how do we, inside of a very congested area, how do we have a new construction? How do we build a new building?
Oh, wow.
And so modular was really a good way to go. And so that's where this kind of got started. And then in 2005, when the BP Texas City explosion happened, things got a lot more regulated, if mm-hmm. you will. Fortunately and unfortunately, incidents drive regulation.
Mm-hmm.
So the standards got a little bit different. Two of the things that really kind of regulate our industry are API RP 752 and 753, American Petroleum Institute Recommended Practice. 752 has to deal with permanent structures, and 753 has to deal with temporary structures. After the 2005 incident, I don't want to go into too much detail about what happened in that, but the people who were killed mm-hmm. were in a temporary structure. And there was no regulation of those structures prior to that. Hmm. And so after that, those structures became regulated. What was considered an occupied building changed. And the way the facility sitings, the congested volumes and that kind of those things that were studied, that was changed. Everything changed in the industry after that.
Hmm.
And so we, not only us, but the whole industry started to experience a lot of growth.
And that was a joint coalition, right? I mean, it was the plants working with OSHA, working Correct. With everybody else. So it was very, you know, everybody was trying to come together to prevent things like this from happening in the future.
Right.
End of the day, these plants, they want people going home safe. They want them coming home to their families.
That's exactly right. And that's the whole point of these types of buildings, is that if there is some kind of upset condition, the people inside the buildings are safe.
So, and I'm just trying to visualize this stuff, but whenever I think of, like, so when you say a modular home, we're talking about something that, or not modular, but a modular building, we're talking about something that can be picked up, mm-hmm. dropped in.
Correct.
And so when I hear the term, like, turnarounds and things like that, when people are bringing in a bunch of workforce in an isolated position, one of these plants, and then shifting gears and getting them in and out, and you can't just have a building that isn't portable, right? Because you've got things coming in and out. So you basically have to find a building that can do that, but then can also meet the safety standards.
Correct.
So that was the solution.
Exactly. Right. And that was something that was foreseen back in 99
yeah.
as something that would be a solution to protect people in those types of circumstances.
So they're like trailer homes on steroids, is what they are.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. I gotta hook you up with my cousins in Arkansas. they're gonna lose it. They're gonna be like, wait a minute, we can make a trailer home that doesn't blow up. This is awesome. So yeah.
We do get a lot of questions at trade shows and things like that.
You think I'm kidding?
No, I don't. We talk to those people.
Okay, cool.
They ask about deer camps and things like that.
They're probably my family. Yeah.
That would be my cousin.
Yeah. Yeah. See, give me your leads list. There's like probably 40,000 leads on there. So yeah. Okay. But go ahead.
No. But you're exactly right. And,
okay.
And because of the portability and flexibility of these types of buildings, even what we consider permanent structures, the ones that aren't for turnarounds and maintenance projects, that kind of thing, if something is built for, say, control room, there is still a lot of flexibility if something about that plant changes.
Hmm.
If a unit changes or something, or if an expansion project happens, investment's not lost. And
right.
so
nice.
that building can be picked up and moved elsewhere, or it can be repurposed. And so the safety's still there, but the investment's not lost.
Hmm. Right. That's awesome.
That is awesome.
So they, you know, kind of recently, I know the previous shows we've been talking about the Sanjet College. Mm-hmm. And y'all made a donation to that. So you want to hit that as a highlight real quick?
Hmm. Sure. We donated two modules, which makes up one building, to make it for their glycol distillation training program. It's going to function as a training control room. I believe the grand opening is going to be in September of this year. There'll be, I don't have all the details on it, but there'll be a tour and whatnot. I know that part of the purpose of it is there's a big drive for workforce development, and so to train the people coming up in real situations. That's part of what the thrust of that was for.
Oh wow! So it's really exciting when we hear the guests and the amount of people who've had a proactive involvement.
Yeah.
Over there at that facility, and so what a blessing. So
it's important as a community, especially as an industrial community, and the challenges that we all face, mm-hmm. that we're all working together to try to meet those challenges and do the best we can working towards the future.
Absolutely. So one of the things that I know is really critical, especially with some of the best from an industrial perspective, is being able to diversify. I know in any market, right, you might start out as the industry leader and then everybody else starts following, and you have to try to figure out ways to stay relevant. You know, and celebrating 20 years, Hunter's got to be doing something right. How are you guys, people hear Hunter Buildings and they think blast-resistant buildings and stuff, but what are you guys doing in addition that maybe people don't know that you do?
Well, over the years, we've diversified. Mm-hmm. We actually have five companies under our umbrella. We have Hunter Buildings and Manufacturing, which is the entity for whom I work. Mm-hmm. We have Hunter Leasing. Mm-hmm. We have Hunter Transportation, so we do own some trucks to truck our buildings. We have Hunter Site Services, which does a plethora of things. They not only install our buildings, but they can do any type of civil or plant work or just about anything that needs to be done in a maintenance-type setting. And we have Hunter International. And we have manufacturing overseas. So our main manufacturing plant is here in Houston, but we also have two other locations to serve the rest of the globe, if you will. And they also do... We have a lot of diplomatic applications, if you can imagine. We have State Department certifications.
Right.
And so there are some areas of the world that aren't as... aren't quite as settled.
Secure. We'll just call them not as secure.
There you go.
That's a nice way of putting it, right?
And so Hunter International serves that sector. And in fact, one of the things that we just started doing, we just finished a building that I can say that nobody has ever done before. It was a typical BRM, if you will, which is what we call our build, blast-resistant module. Is going to, for example, the BP Texas City explosion was about a 6 PSI. Typical on a refinery is 5 PSI, 8 PSI, maybe 10. This one was 300 PSI.
Whoa.
And it has 24,000 pounds just of welding wire in it.
Wow.
And so
that is huge. Nobody
had ever done that before. It was something that, and those are ways in which we're kind of diversifying ourselves. Another outcropping we have seen of our business is people understand they have to protect people, mm-hmm. their personnel. They have to keep their workers safe. One of the things, and this kind of, it was happening before Harvey, but Harvey kind of elevated the situation a bit, if you will. There's a lot of critical equipment at refineries, and I'm not talking about process type stuff, but motor controls, DCS, equipment, starters, and that kind of stuff, and they're contained typically in facilities that are very worth much less than the equipment itself.
Right.
And so
standard metal enclosures.
Correct. Exactly. Right. And so one of the things that's come out that we've kind of moved into, and we've seen our industry move into, is what we call RIEs, or remote instrument enclosures. Hmm. And so you might have millions of dollars worth of equipment that has to be protected from floodwaters, from high wind, such as hurricanes or tornadoes, and that kind of thing. And so we have started to see a real uptick in people requesting those types of facilities.
Well, it makes sense.
Yeah,
I mean,
cool.
When you really think about it, it doesn't do you any good if you have a shed,
mm-hmm.
and all your equipment in your shed gets watered out. It's blown away, right?
Yeah. So people in Arkansas might know that a little bit better.
Huh? No, they trust me. They'll tell you about it. So there's no doubt about that. Yeah, I got to ask you, you just talked about the PSI. I'm sure there's got to be some kind of testing. So Clint, obviously gets to go on all the cool tours and all the fun stuff, and people like to reach out to Clint and take him all these cool places. I don't get to do any of that. How do I get to come out there and test one of these blow-up buildings? Because I want that one. I want to be in the R&D department, and I want to be the guy who gets to come. I just want to push the button.
I'm picturing Wile E. Coyote and the Acme Plunger. Exactly.
I just want it. We'll bring the cameras. It'll be a great episode. We'll do a whole episode on Jason gets to blow stuff up.
So when you figure that out, I want to be your backup. We have physically blast tested our buildings. I was not personally involved in that, but
I want your boss, and I'll have Clint call him because he seems to be the guy with the inside scoop, and he can get us in there and blow stuff up. So I think that's a great time to parlay to a commercial, though, and with the talk about our sponsor. So we'll transfer over to them for a second. Let us tell you about our sponsor, and then we'll be right back.
McCarthy Building Companies. From the Museum of Fine Arts to terminals on the Ship Channel, we understand the challenges and complexities you face when building here in the Gulf Coast. As the oldest privately held national construction company in the country, we have a clear focus on clients, community, and collaboration.
And we're back, and
appreciate our sponsors.
Really,
I'm cutting you off because I want to say thank you to them.
Okay, let's say thank you.
Kick back into it.
I was going to say thank you too, but thank you, Clint, for thanking them for me and the two of us, and on behalf of Stephanie as well. As we get back, we're going to talk a little bit about. Really the advantages from an environmental perspective. I think a lot of people, again, they don't understand that everything centers around, and there's such a core dynamic around safety and the environment, it's often missed. And I was surprised to understand that there was an environmental impact to the modular building. So why don't you loop us in and tell us a little bit about that?
There's a couple of factors on it. First of all, there's low waste. If you go to any construction site, whether it's industrial, residential, whatever.
Commercial.
You're going to see tons and tons of dumpsters. A lot of waste with that type of construction.
Mm-hmm.
With modular construction, there's very little waste because everything's controlled. And so there's less that goes into a landfill. There's less that has to be recycled, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Another factor is because everything's constructed inside an environmentally controlled setting, a lot of the problems you have in, let's say, home construction, a lot of the problems you see with molds and that sort of thing is because I'm just going to use home construction because everybody understands
that.
So you frame up a house, you have rainy season like we had last fall.
Mm-hmm.
That wood, all those materials are sitting there getting rained on, the humidity we have here. All that moisture stays trapped, and so when it's all finished, you've still got all that moisture trapped inside your walls, et cetera, et cetera. So with modular construction, you don't have any of that. Everything's controlled, and so when the buildings go out into the field, you don't have the types of sicknesses and that kind of stuff. So there's some safety impact with that too, as well as just
hygiene,
atmospheric, et cetera. So those are two important factors, I think, as far as. Another advantage of the type of construction that we're talking about.
Yeah, I think that's really dynamic in the sense that you don't really realize this, but it's prefabricated, right? So mm-hmm. it's shown up, and you just said it. I mean, I saw somebody down the street from me. They were getting some remodeling, some work done on their house. Just using it as a great example. And I thought that the other day because it had that shift when it had rained slightly, and it was damp, and then it got real hot. And then you walked out, and you're like, oh, my God, this is nasty. And they were in the midst of the work. So you had half the drywall torn out of this house sitting in the yard, which mm-hmm. I thought, that's horrible. And then the other half sitting out there getting rained on that was getting put back in. I'm like, this doesn't make it. Literally driving down the street. So when you said that to me, I thought, that's genius. So I'm going to just tell my wife, if this house starts falling apart, we're picking it up. My HOA is kind of cheap. I'll just say, I'll pay whatever fine it is. I'm putting in a double wire right here. So, because it's safer. So, and cleaner for the environment.
That's right.
So y'all find me. Clint?
Yeah, so we want to know a little bit more about women in industry. You know, that's one of the reasons that I wanted to personally have you on the show. I've got four kids. Jason has a daughter.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, sorry. So, you know, from a just females in the industry, from women in the industry. I know you wanted to, we both want to know more about that. I mean, how's that, what are you seeing? I mean, what is your take on women in the industry?
It's changed a lot. I've been doing this type of work in this type of industry for about 20 years, a little bit over 20 years. And I've definitely seen a shift. One of the things that used to be true and may still be true to a certain extent is, as a female, you have a little bit of an interesting situation, especially in sales. You may get your foot in the door because you're female, but you better be twice as good once you're in there. You better know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That may not be as true anymore, but that was certainly something that I experienced when I first got into it.
Mm.
I think there's still a bit of a stereotype, especially we're still in a very male-dominated industry. Not as much as we used to be, for sure, but there's still the petrochemical and industrial sales. It's still very male-dominated. If you look around at conferences and that kind of stuff, they're, I would say, less than a third probably mm-hmm. are women. But I think I've seen the level of respect go up a lot. I think that you'll see a lot more very professional women out there. Not trying to down anybody else, but you don't see the types of shiny things that you used to see as representing companies and that kind of thing. But I do think there's a lot more room for growth. I do believe that as much as things have changed, I think there's still sometimes there's a sector of the industry that still may not want to deal with females at some level. There's also some geographic impact to that.
Right.
But by and large, I have to say that I have worked over my career with hundreds, and especially between a customer perspective and coworker perspective, I have never been treated poorly, ever. But I have known people who have. And I hope that changes going forward, especially for y'all's daughters, because right. I think when they get ready to enter the workforce, things will have changed a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
So I think really there's a lot of room for growth, but I think it's come a long way. I have a lot of friends who are older than I am. I still see a lot of women who are still active in a workplace that are 10 or 15 years older than I am that are probably thinking about retirement.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting to me is that they tend to really be close to each other. They share leads. They very much help each other.
Support.
Yeah. And yes, and they help each other be successful. And one thing I have truly found, which is really interesting to me, and maybe it's a maternal thing, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I find that when I observe a female who has been in the industry for quite some time, when they approach a customer who they've known, there's a genuine level of affection, and I don't mean anything wrong with that. I mean a genuine respect and affection for in that relationship, very genuinely, I'm glad to see this person.
Right.
And I don't always see that between guys. And that is not an indictment at any level. It's just again, maybe it's a maternal thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but it's just really interesting. So I think that's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
So
I like to mentor people, especially young people getting in the industry. And whenever I see young ladies getting in the industry, like I said, I want my daughters, if they choose that path, I want them to be welcomed as well. You know, one of the things that is always fascinating to me is y'all ask such good questions and you're not afraid to ask questions. And I think that's awesome. A lot of times, you know, males in the profession, we don't ask all the questions that y'all would ask. And so, but that's a strength that I see from women in the industry that men should learn from women. Because y'all just ask some great questions. You're not afraid to say, why is that there? Right. What does this do? Why is that so shiny and this one's not as shiny, right?
That's interesting.
It's good stuff. Mm-hmm. It really is, and I'm glad you're asking that. So whenever I'm mentoring young people coming into the industry, that's one of the things I'm always ask questions. People love talking about what they do. They love telling you why they do it that way. Ask. They'll tell you.
Yeah, that's a great point. I never thought about that before, but I know that if I was mentoring a young female coming into the industry, I never thought about it, but that is one thing I would say: never be afraid to ask questions. Never be afraid to really you cannot have enough product knowledge, mm-hmm. either for your own product or your own service or what your customers do. Never walk into an environment and not have a clue what you're walking into, at least a little bit.
Right.
And I think that is really a great point. I just never really thought about that before. Maybe it's just innate, but that's really interesting.
Well, I will say, I was at ABC's member breakfast this morning, and there was an entire section, and you know, shame on me, I didn't get the name of what they had started, but it's a piece of the organization that's centered around the women of the industry, and they were very cognizant of it. I mean, the chairman stood up and said, "This room needs more ladies in it," and I thought that was a real powerful statement. And I had been on a mission this summer to take my daughter to introduce her to different jobs, so she's gone to breakfast with me. One of the women we went to lunch with was a CEO of an oil and gas company that's out there on rigs, you know. But she grew up in the trenches, you know, and she shared that story of, you know, 20 years ago what it felt like having to fight for her opportunities, to now she's the CEO of an organization leading these teams and still going out on these rigs and these, you know, not afraid to do it. So, and I wanted to expose her to that. And so it's exciting to know, especially with the need for workforce development, that those jobs are out there for everybody, and you know, we're thankful that they exist, and really exciting stuff.
Well, to expand on that just for a second, one thing I've noticed over the last probably 3 or 4 years,
mm-hmm.
there are a number of female plant or site managers, and up till really then, I'd never met any. Mm-hmm. But in the last 3 or 4 years, both locally and I travel quite a bit, I cover a large territory, I've met very many female, either depending on what the terminology is, plant managers or site managers, and that's impressive.
Yep. Well, I think that's a great chance to talk. We talked a little bit about your experience as a woman in the industry, but why not share a little bit about you? So is there anything that you're predominantly proud of or that you want to share that's
company highlights,
significant things that are happening with you guys and the organization?
Well, I can tell you, for our site services group, which I mentioned, they're our construction arm, if you will, which I don't know if that's the best way to term it, but they're very diversified. They do a number of things. And they won a major award this year. I'm going to read this because I can't remember the exact name of the award, but it's the 2019 Houston Business Roundtable Safety Excellence Award. They won in the hard crafts small category. It's the second time they've won it. They won back in 2016 also. And in order to win, you have to be nominated by customers. They were nominated by 8 customers for that award.
Wow.
And they've won a couple other awards as well. And we're really, really proud of that because most of that is based on safety. And since that's what we're really trying to capitalize on today, I think that really speaks about what our priority as a company is.
Right. That's fantastic.
We had George Parrott on the show from the ISTC. Y'all won an award from them as well,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So you want to highlight that as well?
Yep. Again, I'll have to read. Sorry about that.
No worries.
It's the sustainable record incident rate for 7 consecutive years and 7 years worked without an OSHA loss workday case.
Wow.
That's huge.
7 years, no OSHA case? Lost workday case? That's huge.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's definitely something to be proud of.
We are,
high five, Hunter.
We are very proud of them. I like that. Very nice.
Anything else, Clint?
Yeah. So about you personally, we like to wind down the show by talking about, you know, personal achievements. You read any good books? Are there any charitable organizations you're involved with? Anything else that you want to highlight about just your personal involvements?
I can tell you that I'm really involved with my church.
Okay.
I guess that's considered a charitable organization.
It is, absolutely.
And it's something that I truly am passionate about. One of the ministries I'm involved in is called Family Promise.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know if y'all are familiar with
mm-hmm.
it, but that is something that it is an amazing program for homeless families to mm-hmm. get back on their feet. There's some pretty stringent rules they have to follow in order to get through the program, but I've seen some success stories that have been truly amazing, and I think that those types of things, when I had somebody tell me in my Sunday school class one time that as Christians we're called to be headlights and not dome lights, which I thought was a great thing. And
wow.
I think
I love that.
That's cool.
As industrial partners, as community people, as everything that we do, That's how we should approach our lives, I think. And so that's something I'm proud of, but it's not really a pride thing. I think I'm just really happy to see the success of it.
It's awesome. Yeah, so Thomas Brinsko's the get-together, mm-hmm. they're big supporters of mm-hmm. Family Promise. Mm-hmm. So I've actually got to hear about the ministry several times at his luncheon. So, again, back to the community and the great things that are happening here. They always seem to get intertwined, and it's a great part of – just a good region to be a part of. I'm humble for that. So mm-hmm. with that, we can really talk about what we are grateful for. So sure. We usually close out with a little attitude of gratitude. So, Clint, I'll let you go first this time.
Sure. Well, we talked about daughters and our daughters. So I'm grateful for my children. I really am. They keep me on my toes. They keep me apprised of pop culture.
Yeah,
so I'm apprised. I might have a little more relevance, mm-hmm. Especially when I'm talking with younger people in the industry. I won't throw out any lingo because that's just embarrassing. But I'm grateful for my children. I mean, they're a lot of fun. They're very smart. They're very diligent. And so I'm really looking forward to being a part of their lives for the rest of my life. So
sounds good.
Yeah.
I'm grateful for the economy. It's booming, it's thriving. I think one of our guests talked about all the different work order or all the different work, all the jobs and opportunities that have been created right now. And, I just foresee that as an opportune time for anybody in industry. So I'm really excited about what we're seeing. And that's not a political statement. It's just a real statement. We're having a lot of success. And I think this region in particular has just such a ramp up for growth. And I couldn't be more excited to be a part of it at this time. So, mm-hmm.
Well, I'm grateful for my family, my friends, my job, and the people with whom I work, as well as the country in which we live, which encompasses a lot of things.
Yeah.
Like you said, it's not a political thing. It's just there's a lot of diversification as far as attitudes and as far as beliefs. And I love being a Texan. So I'm grateful for that, too.
Amen.
God bless Texas.
I love being God bless Texas. Yeah. Woo! All right. So, Stephanie, it's been a pleasure having you on the show today with Hunter Buildings. And we're just humbled to get to spend the time in your presence. And so we wish you the best of luck. And we ask you, as always, you can email Economic Alliance if you ever have any questions. If you ever want to get in contact with Stephanie, you can always reach out for questions to myself or to Clint via LinkedIn. And follow us. And so we look forward to seeing you out there in the streets. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.